This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live. HRRN
Live. But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. A special welcome to everybody joining us throughout North America on SiriusXM, and for everybody listening worldwide on our website, horseracingradio.net. We welcome you to the show here this evening. And you know, each and every week I have the opportunity to visit with trainers and to hear their stories and their backgrounds and learn a little something new about them that maybe people didn't know. And regrettably, often we run out of time on the show because, of course, most trainers typically join us for about a half hour and it seems like we're just getting started with their stories and we have to wrap up and move on to our next guest. And I'm hoping that tonight a full hour with trainer Elliot Walden is going to be enough, but I have a feeling he may leave us wanting more at the end of this hour as well. But Elliot Walden is in studio with me here tonight on the Horse Racing Radio Network, 51 years old, a native of Lexington, Kentucky. He trained 1,017 winners in a career that spanned more than 20 years on the racetrack, and those runners earned more than $45 million in purses. In 2005, he stepped away from training on the track to work with Windstar Farm, which is located in Versailles, Kentucky, just a few minutes from Keeneland Racecourse. He is currently the president and CEO and racing manager at Windstar. And again, nice enough to be with me and spend some time here tonight on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. Does that pretty much sum it all up, Elliot? Is that it?
Well, it does. I'm not sure if it's Trainer Talk, if I'm worthy since I don't train anymore.
Oh, come on. You are absolutely worthy of being on this program. 20 years on the racetrack, that makes you worthy of doing an awful lot of things in this game. And really appreciate you being here with me tonight. You know, there's much more to your life and to your career than just the 20 years that you spent on the racetrack, though. And we're going to start at the beginning. You're a third-generation horseman. Your dad was in the business. Your brother is in the business as well. Let's take it from the beginning and tell me about growing up here in Lexington and growing up around the business with your dad having the farm and everything.
Well, my dad did have a farm, and it was named Dearborn, and it was in Midway, Kentucky. It was a home to 300 acres, three or four stallions is typically what he got up to and kind of was his comfort level and would have probably 30 or 40 mares. So kind of a mid-sized farm, a commercial breeding operation. That's how he made his living and did well. You know, he was a great dad and also taught us a lot. The one thing that growing up on the farm taught me was that I wanted to go to the racetrack. I was wanted more action. That the farm seemed a little bit slow for me at the time, and so you know, I've always growing up felt like that I wanted to be in horses, but felt like the farm was too slow. So I migrated towards the racetrack. And my brother Ben enjoyed the farm and grew the farm and you know what ends up happening in a lot of situations, no matter what business you're in, the dad or the patriarch can take it to a level, but then their sons take it a notch up and you know, it doesn't always happen, but with Ben, he took it from you know what dad did with three or four stallions, and when Ben had Vinery, they were up to 35 or 38 stallions in his heyday.
So. Yeah, and for people that might not understand how this all came about, Ben Walden Sr., your dad, founded Dearborn Farm in Midway, and then when he passed away at the age of 67, your brother Ben came in and took over the farm, and as you mentioned, kind of took it to new heights. Where did the name Vinery come from?
Well, Ben actually kind of started his own farm. He did not stay with dad. Once he got out of college, he branched out and did his own thing. And the neat thing about Ben was that he was the first guy to to breed a stallion to more than 100 mares. So
really?
It's amazing now looking
he's
back.
He's a trendsetter.
He's a trendsetter. And you know, he'll tell you today he did it because he needed the money. He needed to pay for the stallions. He didn't have much money and was trying to make it with a young farm. And so he got horses that he was passionate about and Bionic Light and Lost Code and Black Tie Fair. And when people started coming, and he also will tell you he has a hard time saying no to people. He's too nice.
How was that received when he said, okay, I'm going to breed 100 mares with this stallion, and it had never been done before? How was that received by the industry?
Well, I was busy on the racetrack at that time, but like anything in life, when you are a trendsetter and you do something a little different than tradition allows, people, they're naysayers. And so Ben had his share of naysayers, but he also had his supporters as well. And you know, what's neat about anything like that, when you step out of the box and you do something a little different and it works, then all of a sudden the bandwagon comes, and that's what we're seeing today. In fact, maybe too much. Now we've gone from 100 to 200, and you know, I would say that that's too many to breed to a stallion.
You know, you mentioned that you were never one for the farm. You always wanted to be on the racetrack. Your brother decided to obviously do the farm thing. Is that a difference in personalities, do you think?
You know, I don't know. It was something that Ben and I are pretty similar in the fact that we're both type A, very aggressive, you know, want to go out and make things happen. So from that standpoint, we have a similar personality. I think in some ways it might have been an internal decision not to get in each other's way, you know, possibly. But I was gravitating towards the action of the racetrack. You know, when you step on a racetrack, there's an energy level that's there when you walk through the grandstand and when you're waiting for the first race. And that all excited me as a teenager going to school. I couldn't wait to get out of school to go to the Keeneland in the afternoon and things like that. So, you know, I was more geared towards that. And Ben, I think, basically decided to do what he knew, and that's growing up on the farm and really grow that. And you know, a lot of people kind of get into the horse business because they grow up on it. It's all they know. And then they try to do well at it. And that's what Ben did and has done extremely well.
Did you ever have any thoughts of doing anything other than being in the horse business?
I didn't. And you know, that to me is a blessing. I never had any thoughts other than training horses. So I was focused from the time I was 14. And I think from that standpoint, it helped me become a trainer at 22. And you know, because every day that I was on the racetrack or, you know, living on the farm even, we were looking at racing forms and listening to Ursel Ellis on the radio.
Sure.
Right. So, you know, I think that when you're focused on something, it can accelerate your timeline to be able to accomplish your goals. And so I never wanted to do anything but train horses.
You had a quote after your dad passed away, losing that battle with cancer, and you said, he taught me how to treat people and how to interact personally and professionally. Is that the one thing that you really took away from your dad and the one thing he really instilled in you?
Yeah. I mean, you know, dad was, you know, to this day, I have people come up and tell me how that dad treated him a certain way, and that dad, it didn't matter who they were. You know, that's the neat thing. You know, a lot of people will treat people with money well.
Yeah.
But it's when the groom or the hot walker comes up and says, you know, your dad was really nice to me. I needed somebody to talk to, or I needed $20. And to show love when you know you're not going to get anything in return, that's what's makes the mark of a man. And I think that dad did that well, because I had people from all over, all gamuts from, and that's the great thing about this business. You interact with kings and queens, and you interact with people that don't have much. And that's the beauty of the horse industry as a whole.
Did your dad always want his sons to be in the horse business?
You know, he never pushed for it.
Yeah.
He was very supportive. In fact, he gave me my first horses to train. So, you know, he was always very supportive and he watched Ben grow and was very proud of Ben, and Ben was stepping out of a box that he was not, you know, he kind of had it set with the number of horses that he was comfortable with, and Ben was just blowing it out of the water. So, you know, I think he was very proud of that and as well. And yet watching with a, wow. I mean, you know, but you know, again, I'm not so sure with Ben's career, probably, he saw more. You know, he passed away kind of right the year Victory Gallop was running. So from my standpoint, he didn't really get to see the best of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, he always believed in us both.
Yeah, Victory Gallop, of course, the winner of the Belmont Stakes and went on to be voted Horse of the Year. We're going to talk about him. Ben Walden Jr., your brother, also a noted horseman. As we talked about, he decided to stick with the farm side of things. What's your relationship like with your brother today? Will you still bounce ideas off of each other?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're very close. And we, you know, I lean on him quite a bit, actually, in the role I'm in now, because he's, you know, he spent the last 30 years applying his trade to the stallion business. And nobody did it better when he was rolling with Vinery before he sold it. Like I said, you know, it's funny. We have 20. Three stallions at Windstar now, and everybody thinks we have a lot. And you know, I said that to Ben one day, and he goes, "Well, we had 38 when we
had so. Yeah, I think I said Victory Gallop was Horse of the Year. I think he was Eclipse Champion older male, right? I don't know if he didn't get Horse of the Year.
He did not get Horse of the Year, but he was you know, his career that in his 4-year-old year got cut short after the Whitney, or he probably would have been.
Yeah. Elliot Walden joining me here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. When you started training, you went out on your own at the age of, what, 22, I guess, in 1985. Who were some of the people that you had the privilege to learn from before you went out on your own?
You know, the main guy that I learned from was a trainer named Dennis Ebert. And Dennis is not a household name, but was an extremely good teacher, and he came from a lineage of the Frank Whiteley school. He was an assistant for David Whiteley and Frank Whiteley and when they had Forgo and some really good horses, and that's kind of where he learned his trade, and yet he was a great teacher. He had trained for my dad, and they had had quite a bit of success together. He had a filly named Enumerating who won the Ashland, had a filly named Unaccompanied who was undefeated, won the Old Hat Forward Gown Bonnie Mist, and then got struck by Laminitis. She was really probably the best horse he ever trained and the best horse my dad ever owned. But he was a great teacher.
And of course, you learned from Leroy Jolly.
Leroy Jolly was great, name. And he was, you know, has always been very helpful. You know, I remember going out to Fasig Tipton and really not really asking my parents, but again, focused on what I wanted to do. So I knew I wanted to go to Saratoga at the age of 14,
yeah,
and walk Hots, and knew that that's where I needed to be and didn't need to be rubbing yearlings in the yearling barn. So, dad took me out to Fasig Tipton, and I walked up to Mr. Jolly and asked him for a job, and he was gracious enough to allow me to come up there, and so I spent two to three years working for him up there, and in the summer times.
You knew you wanted to do this so much that you tried to go do the college thing at University of Kentucky, did that for a couple of years, and then said, you know what, I want to be involved with horses, right?
That's right. No, and while I was at college, I was involved with horses. That was the problem. I was out at Keeneland working and not going to class. So that's not what I was about.
That's a common thread between trainers that grew up here in Lexington. Kieran told me the same thing, and his story was very similar, where he tried to go to school and just always wanted to be at the racetrack and be involved with the horses. So he did the same thing. He dropped out and went to the racetrack. It's worked out pretty well for him. Did you know many of the other trainers that we see today that grew up in Lexington, guys like Kieran? Did you kind of hang out with them?
I really didn't know Kieran
much.
You know, I wonder why that is at times because of that. But I think, you know, it's who you work for. And Kieran went on his way with Wayne and was traveling across the globe, you know. But know Kieran very well now and very good friend. But I think, you know, when you train horses, and I've talked to college students now in my role at Windstar. And you know, there is a, I wouldn't say an expectation, but, you know, when you graduate from college and yet you want to be in the horse business, you know, it's tough to have those guys step back and want to start mucking stalls and learn. But the best way to learn in the horse business is to learn from the ground up. So, you know, it's hard for college graduates to get that. And what I recommend to students and young people is do it while you're in college. You know, get a job in the summer, like and not forego your education, but because your education is needed. But to actually start that groundwork while you're in college, so that when you get out, you're ready to move on.
Well, your first year of training horses, again, 1985, you trained 3 winners that year. Kind of a tough year. Were you thinking that maybe this was a mistake?
No. You know, the one thing about, I only had 8 horses,
yep.
I think. And one thing about my career that was a blessing was that every single year up to 99, we increased our purses for the year. So there was never a year it went backwards. So, you know, that for me was gratification at the end of the year. Okay, I did a little better than last year. You know, let's keep going.
Yeah.
Now, stakes winner-wise, I don't think it came till 1990-something. So there was a gap of 6 or 8 years, you know, before I had a stakes winner. A filly named Secret Advice won the Regret.
Yep.
But, you know, I did take pride that every year we increased our earnings for our stable. And one of the things that happened in 85 that was pretty cool was we had a horse for my dad named Sibling, and he's by Alitab, and he broke his maybe my first winner at Ellis Park. And then we ran him an opening day at Keeneland going 7 furlongs, and he got beat a neck and nose in 40 lengths. I mean, he got beat a long way. And there was a race 5 days later going 1 mile and 1/16, and Pat Day was open. And so I went in to see his old agent coach at the time. It was before Fred Amy and Doc Danner.
Okay.
And told coach I wanted to run this horse back and I tried to talk him into riding him, you know. And he didn't have anything else to ride, so he ended up riding him, and he went to the lead and he won. Back in, I think it was 4 or 5 days rest. I think it was Saturday back to Wednesday.
So. Wow.
Old school. Pretty cool. Yeah, and that old school, and that was at Keeneland. So that was in the fall that year.
Well, Pat Day is somebody who has had a tremendous influence on your life. I think I had read somewhere where you said that at one point earlier in your career, you were kind of struggling a little bit, and mm-hmm. then you heard Pat talk mm-hmm. at a luncheon here in Lexington, and it's somewhere in the early 90s. Talk about that.
Yeah, 94.
Okay.
Yep, and Pat gave his testimony about how Jesus had turned around his life and, you know, he was going down a wrong path. Drugs were part of that lifestyle that he was living, and he was having success, but it didn't mean anything. You know, it was very fleeting. And that's what resonated with me, because as a trainer, every day's different. You're winning very little and you're losing a lot. You know, a good trainer is a 30%, 25% trainer. So that means you're losing 75% of the time. So if you don't know how to handle that, or it can really eat at you. It can eat at you in your home life. It can eat at you with your work. And I was really struggling with that. So Pat spoke about that. He spoke about things that are more important than winning and losing, even though we're all very, God made us all very competitive to be in this business to begin with. And so what he said resonated with me to a point where I gave my life to Christ at that point and have endeavored to live differently since then.
Did you notice a difference? It seemed like at that point your career really took off. Was that because of a internal peace, I guess, can we call it?
You know, I think it definitely could.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that, you know, God doesn't bless you just because you accept him. There's plenty of people that are Christians, or there's plenty of people that believe in God that have struggles in life. So I'm not a big believer in, you know, you believe in God because he's going to turn around and bless you. But when you trust him with your life, then whatever happens is going to be okay. And so it does take some of that pressure off of the winning and losing. Now, again, there's not too many more people that are competitive as me. And if people saw me at one of my son's basketball games, they wouldn't say I was very Christian. So,
well, it's okay. That's, you're allowed to do those type of things. Right. Absolutely.
Right. We're not perfect.
You had a quote hanging in the shed row, which was a quote from Proverbs, which I thought was pretty cool. Talk about that.
Proverbs 21:31. A horse is made ready for the day of battle, but victory rests with the Lord. And we have it hanging in our office at Windstar as well.
Why that particular quote?
Because it speaks to you doing your work, doing it well, doing it hard, but at the end of the result is the Lord's. Whatever happens, you get the horse ready. And that can apply to anything. It can apply to you on your radio show.
Sure.
You give it your best, you do your best, and then you leave the results to God.
Elliot Walden, my special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So what was your first big break when you were on the racetrack?
Oh, I think, as far as training or before that?
Yeah, well, getting you started and really elevating your career to another level.
I think the winning, I tell you what a big break was. And this is what I talk to people about, trainers, young trainers that, trying to figure out where to go, you want to be. Charlie Whittingham used to say, you put your horses in the worst company and you put yourself in the best company. And,
sure.
And I think that there's a lot of truth in that. And so a big break that I had many of them, but one of the big breaks was I decided to go to Saratoga, and I knew that I didn't really have the horses to go up there at the time. And in those days, Churchill, and it still does today, ends around July 4th. And sometimes before that they were running all summer. And so we would try to stay there all summer, but typically they end July 4th, and then you'd hang around to Ellis and if you were on the Kentucky circuit.
Okay.
So I decided to go to Saratoga and was 0-for-22 the first 4 weeks of the meet, and was in the barn with Bill Mott. He had the whole barn, was rolling, was training for Firestone, leading winners over there every other day and every day, and watching this, not only struggling, but watching what success looked like.
Sure.
And I remember that Rich Decker and Art Preston walked in the barn, and they were looking for me because they had just bought a filly named Burr from Billy Badgett, and she'd just broken her maiden, and they were looking for a trainer. And I had trained a horse for them previously named Never Wavering that they bought into. So, because I was there, I got the horse. And even though I was 0-for-22, if I wasn't at Saratoga, they would have given the horse to somebody else. And so I got Burr. She wins. We come home. We run her in the Kentucky Juvenile Fillies at Turfway on Kentucky Cup Day. She wins that. She then in the fall beats Cara Raffaella in the Pocahontas at Churchill, and they buy Victory Gallop, and they want a trainer, and they send him to me.
Timing is everything.
Timing is everything, and putting yourself in a position to be successful. And I think about that a lot. Even though the meet didn't go well, being in the right place at the right time, and some of that's luck. But some of it's also having vision to understand where you need to be and what your objectives are.
You mentioned being in the barn of Bill Mott at Saratoga, and a lot of trainers on this program will tell me they had people that they would talk to as they were just getting started in the game and that they would lean on for advice. Did you have a confidant on the racetrack that you would go talk with?
Bill's always been really close. Bill, because I was in the barn with him at Saratoga, and that was for a couple of years. I did that. I always leaned on him, and he's been great. And when I quit training, he now trains some of our horses along with Todd Pletcher. Those are the two guys that I went to first.
Yeah.
At Windstar when I decided to come back to the farm, and Bill's trained Drosselmeyer for us, who won the Belmont and won the Breeders' Cup Classic.
Do you try to find trainers that you feel have a similar style to yours when you were training?
Well, the interesting thing is Bill and Todd probably have different styles. And so, I've used have both of those guys on the team because they do have different styles, and it helps complement the whole stable of horses. As far as when I trained, I probably gravitated a little bit more towards Bill. And that might be just a little, you know, Todd's very aggressive, and Todd has there's nobody that's going to go down in history that's a better trainer than Todd Pletcher that I can imagine in the next 100 years.
Sure.
I mean, the success he's had, and he's not even 50, is amazing. I mean, I don't think he's even 40. I think he's 46 or something, 45.
Yeah, he's still a young man.
He's a young man. And to think of it, it's amazing. I had had quite a bit of success with some grass horses. Like Bill gets labeled with grass horses, and the Triple Crown success is something that I feel good about, and also kind of takes you to that. You talk about breaks. When you get a Triple Crown horse, that's a break for any trainer, because all of a sudden you're getting $100,000 worth of advertising for free.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what would your philosophy, how would you sum up your philosophy for training horses?
Take care of the horse and he'll take care of you. I think, you know, a lot of times you run horses in spots that you don't feel good about, or you force. And most of the time that doesn't work.
Yeah.
A lot of times, and sometimes that might be because of an owner decision. You know, you might have to run a horse because of an owner decision. That owner's putting pressure on you, or you're worried about saving your job. So you run a horse, you kind of acquiesce. It just, as long as you take care of the horse will take care of you.
That's a great point. And it's a tough position, I think, for a lot of trainers, because they have to look out for their owners, but yet you're trying to look out for the best interest of the horse. Is that sometimes difficult to balance those two?
I think the what I've always said, and I you learn from your experiences, but when we had Ecton Park and Menifee, they were in the same year right after Victory Gallop.
Yeah.
Both on the Triple Crown Trail, both in the Derby. Ecton Park was placed in the Louisiana Derby. So he made it to the Derby, and then Menifee won the Bluegrass. So we come to the Kentucky Derby, and you've got two horses in, and then one runs great. Probably should have won. Had a tough trip that day. Menifee got hung out wide and came, just was eating up ground the last eighth of a mile. And then Ecton Park didn't run well. But move forward to the end of the year, they're both kind of at the end of the Travers, and we're looking where to run them in September. And the Super Derby is a 5-horse field. Now, Menifee is the favorite. For Ecton Park, it made sense to run him there as well. And the issue was, there's 5 or 6 horses in the race. I've got 2 of them. No, somebody's going to be mad. But the way that I explained it to Mark Stanley, who owned Ecton Park, and Mr. Hancock Arthur, who owned Menifee, is if I do what's right for the horse, it's going to do what's right for you. And by putting the horse in the right spot, and it was the right thing for Ecton Park to run. So if I would have tried to split them because my own preferences would be to try to win 2 races instead of 1, that's not what's doing right for the horse or what's right for the owner. So I always tried to put my horses and my owners ahead of my own objectives.
I'll continue my visit with trainer Elliot Walden next here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. And we'll talk about a little horse by the name of Victory Gallop. It's coming up next here on HRN. Stay tuned.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live, presented by Fasic Tipton. Where will you be this summer? The Fasic Tipton 2014 yearling sales will be here before we know it, so make plans now. The July sale in Lexington, Kentucky will be held July 14th. In 2013, the sale boasted an average of more than $89,000 and a median of $72,000, and the percentage rate of return of 43% was the third highest of any yearling sale in North America. The Saratoga sale on August 4th and 5th is always one of the top international yearling marketplaces. The
sales $295,000 average in 2013, maintains its leadership role, and with the highest percentage of profitable yearlings among all sales in North America this past year, it's the only place to be this August. New York bred yearlings are in the spotlight August 9th and 10th in Saratoga, with a $430,000 average and major increases in both average and median in 2013, the New York bred sale is the most productive auction for the cream of the New York bred crop. So where will you be this summer? DerbyBox.com is the world's only full-time tour and travel company devoted predominantly to thoroughbred racing and the Kentucky Derby. A local Louisville area business since 1998, DerbyBox.com offers more than 25 years first-hand experience in Kentucky Derby travel and ticket packages. At DerbyBox.com, you'll find tickets and packages for every budget and taste, from Millionaire's Row to the infield. So don't delay. Book your trip to the 2014 Kentucky Derby today at DerbyBox.com. DerbyBox.com is in no way affiliated with Churchill Downs or Ticketmaster. Breathing easy is the key to equine performance and health. That's why horsemen around the world count on Flair nasal strips to protect the lungs of their equine athletes without drugs. Flair Strip's gentle support of the nasal passages reduces the soft tissue collapse that occurs in all horses during intensive exercise. 7 clinical studies prove the benefits of Flair strips for reducing lung bleeding, reducing fatigue, and shortening recovery time. Reduce bleeding, recover faster, perform better. Prevent, protect, perform with Flair strips.
The Kentucky Derby runs here.
And he's going clear by two lengths and running to the line. Animal Kingdom wins the Derby. I'll Have Another takes the lead in the Derby and up the line. I'll Have Another wins the Derby. Jarvis War is absolutely fine. It's had his golden soul, but it is all to win the Derby.
The 140th Kentucky Derby, May 3rd, exclusively on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
This is Al Stahl, and you're listening to Horse Racing Radio Network.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, visiting with trainer Elliot Walden for the entire hour here this morning. Really enjoyable visit in the first half of the program, and looking forward to hearing more stories upcoming here in the second half. If you do miss any portion of this show, you can go back to our website later on this afternoon. A podcast will be available for you at horseracingradio.net. You can listen at your leisure on the website, on your phone, or on iTunes, whatever works best for you. And I hope you're enjoying the program here tonight. Elliot, we've kind of covered so much of your early days on the racetrack and your background, your family history. In 1995, you had your first Grade 1 winner with Hawk Attack, who won the Secretariat Stakes at Arlington. It had to be an extremely special day for you.
It was, and you know, to be training for the governor at the time, and Governor Jones was in office, and for him to put his faith in me, you know, being a local guy, was, and you've seen what he's done for, you know, the advancement of Larry Jones's career. Obviously, Larry's a great trainer, but, you know, Governor Jones has great horses and breeds great horses, and so having a guy like that behind you is extremely gratifying, and it was a joy to share that with him.
Yeah, what do you remember about that day?
I remember that Pat Day was on Hawk Attack, and he had won the first race of that series, the Arlington Classic, I think, and we had to skip the second one. And so we ran in the Secretariat, and I remember Pat saying that in the paddock that, you know, this horse was always forwardly placed, and that the rail at Arlington, when they come to the quarter pole, the actual rail, when they have it out a little bit, which they do for the million, they have it on the outer setting. So they set a temporary rail. Well, the temporary rail breaks away and actually breaks back to the inside. When they turn for home, it actually creates a lane where the horse is going around. If the horse is on the rail and he's going around, when he comes off of the turn, he's in the two path, not the one path.
Okay.
Or he has to go back to the inside.
Sure.
So Pat said that his plan was to sit behind the leaders, and then when they came to that point of the elbow, that he would make his break, and he did exactly that. And he's sitting behind, and when they came off the turn, he shot to the inside. And Hawk Attack was a very agile horse, shot to the inside and opened up, and it was pretty cool to see it all play out the way that Pat had described it. That didn't always happen.
Well, Pat was a great tactician, wasn't he?
You know, I think Pat was a great rider.
Yeah.
But Pat did a lot of it by feel. I mean, okay. Pat did not have a whole lot of preparation. I mean, he would look at the form, but, you know, he would come to the paddock and he'd be kissing children and hugging babies and say he didn't want a lot of instructions. You know, he by the time he got to you as a trainer, it was time to throw him up on the horse. You know, he didn't want you telling him a lot.
Did you ever try to give him instructions?
Oh, yeah, and it usually failed. You know, usually we did our worst because I rode Pat a lot. I mean, Pat and I were a combination around here because I was having some success here in Kentucky and was the leading trainer in a few spots. And so Pat would always, you know, my goal was to get Pat Day whenever I could. I mean, that's just the way as a trainer, you know, some people have different strategies on how to align themselves with jockeys. My philosophy was get the best you could get. In every single time.
Sure.
And so Pat would jump in and off horses a lot. And I didn't feel like that, you know, riders, I didn't feel like I owed, if a horse jockey rode a horse for me and it was a one race contract. And the next time, you know, I would go back to Pat if I could get him.
Yeah.
And that's just the way that my philosophy worked and it worked for us. And so Pat and I had a lot of success.
Well, the mid to late 90s were really a meteoric rise for you. Along comes Victory Gallop in 1998. And a lot of people will forget that Victory Gallop didn't start his career with you, mm-hmm. nor for owners Prestonwood Farm.
That's right. And that goes back to that, what I was saying about Burr and in 98, 97. Late 97, the fall of 97, the Prestons reached up and bought Victory Gallop on behalf of they bought it on the advice of Jerry Brown at Thoroughgraph. He had seen him, he had seen his numbers and liked the horse, and so they went after him, and the horse didn't vet exceptionally well. I know that there were some questions about whether we should even purchase him or not. He had a sesamoid that was elongated from injury as a foal. And so one sesamoid was twice as big as the other one. And, you know, it's just when you're spending a lot of money and you're looking at x-rays and you're trying to predict the future, it's a tough call. And they stepped up to their credit and bought the horse anyway. Somebody had turned him down before that, and they stepped in and bought him and sent him to me at Payson Park, and the rest is history.
In your first start with him, you put him right into the Rebel Stakes at Oaklawn Park. Why that race?
We were running out of time. You know, I'd had him at Payson Park, and he was training well, but he wasn't. He had a little filling in a upper check area that I didn't like. And I thought it was the deep surface at Payson, so I moved him to the fairgrounds with my assistant Shannon Ritter, who's now a trainer. And so we got him working, and he started working really well. And the Rebel was on March 15th or something. Was the, you know, two preps before the Derby, and horse hadn't run yet at three, so
sure,
it's a lot of pressure there.
He brings you to your first Kentucky Derby. Mm-hmm. For a kid growing up in the horse business in Lexington, does it get any better than that?
No. Than getting better than that.
Yeah, talk about that experience going down, well, throughout Derby week with him. You arrive at Churchill Downs. What was that like for you?
Yeah, it was tense, you know. I mean, you want to do well, you want to put your best foot forward, and the first time that you go through that experience, I don't think there's any accident that the same trainers show up at the Kentucky Derby most of the time.
Yeah.
I think that it takes training a horse a certain way. It takes knowing when to press a little bit. And it also takes understanding the whole concept of things. So being there for the first time was a little stressful because there's so much you got to deal with. And you talk about Super Bowl athletes that talk about, you know, they get to Super Bowl week and they got their tickets for their family and all that. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that goes into it that you just don't think about. And I remember Victory Gallop. Victory Gallop was always a little sensitive from allergies as well. And so I remember him coughing a couple times on Tuesday. And, you know, at every, you know, when a horse coughs, it's like, you know, who's that? Who, you know, of course, then it's Derby week. You know? So you can't say move the race back 2 weeks. You know? So I remember pulling blood on him Wednesday morning and making sure that he was okay. And just the weight and the pressure of getting that blood result back to make sure that he was okay was very intense.
Were there a few prayers being said
Yes, there was.
He finishes second, a fast closing second to Real Quiet. I'm always going to remember that Kentucky Derby. It was the Derby in which my wife and I got engaged. It was our first Derby being in attendance. We got engaged there. So I always remember Victory Gallop and that late charge that he made. Describe your emotions right after the race. Was it joy that we just finished second in the Derby, or was it more like, darn it, we were so close?
You know, it's tough to get beat a neck or a head, you know, I mean, yeah. I'd rather get beat five lengths, especially when you're competitive. But, you know, I was reminded of Proverbs 21:31, right? So you get the horse ready and the victory rests with the Lord, or defeat. You can't. So, you know, immediately, and look, this isn't always the way it is, but immediately my mind went to, well, you know what? You can't just say it and speak it and not live it. So, you know, I felt at peace with being second. Now, looking back on it now, there's times that in the flesh I want to, golly, especially, you know, the next year as well. So,
yeah,
you know, just this close.
You know? Your faith was really tested. You had to be thinking after Victory Gallop that this was going to be your only shot.
Yeah,
and then comes Menifee the next year.
Right.
And he loses by a neck to Charismatic, and he was charging at the end as well. Which one of those was more difficult to swallow?
Second one.
Yeah.
You know, just doing it 2 years in a row like that and coming up short. Felt like the Buffalo Bills.
Yeah, it's rough. That was very rough. I can't even imagine being in that position and what that had to be like for you.
Well, you just have to remind yourself that you're blessed to be in that position, you know, and think about all the trainers. You know, you're on Trainer Talk here. Think about all the trainers across the country that would say, you know what, I'll take second. Let me get beat like that every time.
Yeah, and to do it 2 years in a row.
Do it 2 years in a row. And so
did you think you would get back after Victory Gallop?
No, I think you're right. I think it was, you know, when you think about Menifee, Menifee is a horse that probably was as big and a physical, talented horse that I've ever had. A gorgeous horse out of a very good mare named Ann Campbell. We broke his maiden at Monmouth, and he was pretty offset in his knees, so he only sold for like $38,000 as a yearling. He was out of an old mare by Harlan. Arthur really liked him, so I ended up putting in Jimmy Stone, who was an owner that Arthur had relationships with as well, in from New Orleans, and Arthur stayed in for half. And so, you know, the interesting thing about Menifee is he broke his maiden at Monmouth in his 2-year-old year. We sent him to Saratoga, and I said, well, you know what, I'm going to take it easy with him because he just kind of won at Monmouth. And even though he won extremely impressively, I'm not going to run him in the Saratoga special. I'm going to run him in allowance race, and then we'll get him ready for the hopeful. You know, in those days, you didn't jump right in graded stakes like you do now. So he runs in this allowance race. He wins by 5, and he ends up chipping his knee. But the horse that was second was Cat Thief, and the horse that was third was Lemon Drop Kid. And here I'm thinking I'm in an easy spot.
Sure.
Yeah, and he dusts him. Lemon Drop Kid's 10 back. And so, you know, you look back on history, that might be the toughest allowance race ever.
Yeah, that's pretty brutal. That's a salty allowance race, as they say. Back to Victory Gallop for just a minute, because he ends up bringing you to the highest pinnacle of racing, winning a classic race with the Belmont Stakes after being beaten twice by Real Quiet in the Derby and then in the Preakness. But after the Preakness, were you thinking, okay, the next one's a mile and a half. Now you're coming into our realm here. Did you feel like you had a pretty good shot moving forward?
You know what? No, I didn't really. Yeah. I thought Real Quiet's beat us twice, and I felt like we were hanging on. You know, Victory Gallop, going back to kind of his allergic reactions to things, he came out of the Preakness with a terrible skin disease. I mean, we couldn't even put the saddle on him for a couple of days. And a lot of it had to do with stress. You know, and he wasn't a big horse. So, you know, he had gotten kind of light and, you know, he gave it his all. I mean, that's one thing about him. He gave it 110% every time he went on the racetrack. And he was such a professional. I mean, on race day, he would lie down. You know, when you pulled his water bucket and his hay tub 4 hours before the race, he knew, hey, I'm running. I'm going to get some rest.
Yeah.
And so he'd lay down, helicopters buzzing around Kentucky Derby. He's out. And so, you know, I knew that he would give it his best, but going through the skin disease, we had him on antibiotics to get rid of the skin disease, for the first week after the Preakness. Then the middle week, you know, things started. We were able to train him a little bit. I only breezed him once and he breezed like 5/8 and 103 or something on the Sunday or Monday before the Belmont. But really that last week, that last 4 or 5 days before the Belmont, you could start to see his coat come in, start to see that look. I needed every bit of the 21 days that we had. So I wasn't extremely confident that we could beat Real Quiet going in.
You know, if you didn't run him in that race, we're looking at the first Triple Crown winner in the sport since 1978. So you were obviously the spoiler that year. What was that like as you being a racing fan, somebody who grew up in the business? What was it like to play spoiler on that day?
Well, I've been asked that question a lot. What did it feel like? Did you feel bad?
Yeah.
And the answer is no, because Victory Gallop deserved to win one of those. You know, I felt like he deserved to win the Derby. Preakness, he got beat pretty much fair and square. We changed tactics, tried to get in front of Real Quiet with Gary Stevens on him, and Gary said, let me go after him early, and that didn't really work. It wasn't Victory Gallop style, and Real Quiet won very easily. But I think he deserved to win one. So I felt great for the horse, great for the connections. And, you know, the way that I've described it since is Real Quiet wasn't meant to be a Triple Crown winner or he wouldn't have let us win. And you know, I mean, you can look at things and you can say what ifs, but Triple Crown winners, they get the job done.
Yeah.
And not to take anything away from Real Quiet. He's a great horse. I'd love to have him. Love to have trained him.
Yeah.
You know, great horse to have and a super horse, but Triple Crown winners don't let somebody else sneak up on him. So I don't feel bad about Victory Gallop. I think he deserved to win one as well.
Yeah, Bob Baffert trained Real Quiet. Mm-hmm. Did you have conversations with Bob after the race at all?
I give Bob a hard time now just because I'll never forget right after the race, he came up to me and we had a conversation about this two weeks ago out at Barrett's. But he came up to me. I was in a golf cart because I'd broken my ankle. And so I'm going back to the barn after the press conference and everything. And Bob waves me over. And so we come over and he says, hey, congratulations. But it's not like winning the Derby. So I said, man, you are hard on a guy. You know, you just win and, you know, you could just say congratulations, leave it at that. But you gotta dig it in a little bit. And so I reminded him of that story this couple weeks ago. And he said, well, I was right. It's not like winning the Derby. You agree now, don't you? Because we had the success with Super Saver. And I said, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, in typical Bob Baffert fashion as well. And you mentioned having broken your ankle. You were on crutches for the Belmont Stakes that year, so you weren't even able to saddle Victory Gallop to the victory.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, I thought about it long and hard. And while Victory Gallop was a really cool customer, I just didn't think being on crutches, it happened. I broke my ankle playing basketball, trying to stay fit about 8 days or 9 days before the Belmont. And so I was casted up to my knee. And
who was your pinch hitter?
Bill Mott. So, you know, everybody thinks Bill Mott's first Triple Crown saddle winner was Drosselmeyer, but it actually was Victory Gap. We joke about that all the time.
When you finally decided to walk away from the sport on the racetrack side of things and join Windstar Farm, Kenny Trout, Bill Kasner, was it difficult for you to walk away?
Yeah, it was. You know, I think that, you know, I'd talked to Kenny about he had come to me and I was a private trainer for Windstar at the time. And we had discussed things and things weren't going as well as he had envisioned or I had envisioned. You know, we were winning 20% of our races, but Kenny and Bill had invested a lot in the game, and so we were, you know, 2003, 2004 was kind of a quiet time. So Kenny came and said, look, what if we move the horses around and you come back and oversee that and become vice president to Doug and help Doug with things on the farm and oversee the racing. And so, you know, I had a decision to make at that time, whether I go try to create a public stable again and get up to 120 horses. And quite honestly, my family had a lot to do with that decision at the time, because I had teenagers that are in high school and they're involved and, you know, there's a short window left to be with them. And I knew that training horses and going at it like with 25 or 30 clients and trying to develop that, grow that stable to 120 horses again would be a monumental task. It could be done. I didn't lack confidence that we could do it, but I also felt like it was going to take me to Florida in the wintertime. Yeah. And they didn't want to move.
And you're going to be away from your family.
That's right. And then when I, you know, at the end of it, they'd be gone. You know, because they were sophomore, freshman in high school. And so this allowed me the opportunity to stay at home, travel one or two days to Florida and come back. And I prayed about it and felt a real peace about transitioning. And it felt a peace about not having pride in the fact that, you know, I had to be the trainer of record, that I could step back a little bit. And I've had people ask me a lot since then. Every time I go to the racetrack, I get somebody asking me, do you miss training? And quite honestly, there's times I do, but there's also times that I don't. And it's created more family time. It's created a great opportunity at Windstar to we're into everything. And the, you know, one thing I would say about training horses is that people need to understand trainers work extremely hard 7 days a week doing the same thing. And it can get mundane. You know, it is a grind, and it's no different than probably an NFL coach or a college basketball coach. It's a 24/7 occupation. I'm in a 24/7 occupation from a standpoint but there is some more downtime. You know, Sundays have changed a lot. Doesn't mean I don't get a phone call or we don't go out and look at a horse on Sunday or go watch a race, but Sundays have changed a lot. And so that, from that standpoint, it's been good.
Visiting with Elliot Walden on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on HRRN. He is the president and CEO and now racing manager at Windstar. It appears from listening to you talk, Elliot, and from knowing you over the past several years, that Windstar has really been the right decision and a great fit for you.
It has. And, you know, when that point of decision was upon us in 05, you know, I had a decision to make that, you know, go and try to get some owners. And like I said, I didn't have any lack of confidence that we could get that done. But I had invested a lot of time in Windstar and had seen Windstar get to this point and felt like that Kenny and Bill had a vision that very few people in this industry have. And Kenny especially Kenny, you know, he thinks big. He is a big thinker.
Sure.
So, you know, those are the guys that I want to be aligned with. And so I told Kenny I wasn't going anywhere and was going to wrap around his leg until he got out of the business. So that's what happened.
You mentioned your children a couple of times. Do they have any interest in being in the horse game?
They do. They do. Will is my oldest, and, yep. And Rebecca and I, have four children. And Will's actually working for Todd Pletcher, down at Palmetto's right now.
Nice.
He tried the college thing similar to myself for a year or two. It didn't work. And he's very passionate about it, and I think he'll end up training horses, probably in the near future.
That's interesting. I can imagine the conversation was a bit easier with you than it would be with some dads when he came to you and said, hey, Dad, I think I'm going to drop out of college and go work on the racetrack. Was that a bit easier?
It was a lot easier. Yeah.
And
I got it. I got it.
Yeah. How about the other kids?
Mac is in school at a school called Tribeca Nazarene, and he's 21. Mm-hmm. He's enjoying college, playing basketball, Division II basketball. It's a Division II school, and doing well. And then Emily goes to TCU. She's a twin. She's Mac's twin. And she's 21 as well, and she's going to TCU in Fort Worth, and she's very focused. She's probably as passionate as Will about the horse business.
Yep.
Mac is has some different interests, but all of them love the horses. And then Megan, we have a 10-year-old, so that'll keep us young.
Basketball seems to be a recurring theme throughout this interview here tonight. Is that obviously growing up here in Lexington, it's kind of ingrained in you, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
It is. And horses and basketball are ingrained. And all three of the oldest kids played basketball. And that was one of the decisions back in 05. They were all playing at the time. And it was a lot of fun. In fact, Emily went to in March, she went to the state tournament as a basketball player. At Christian Academy of Louisville, they went down there, and that was a great experience. And, you know, if I would have had to been away, it would have been tough.
Are you intense when you watch their games?
A little bit. Yeah. A little bit.
When you look back at the guy staring you in the mirror, what are you most proud of with your life, with your career?
Ooh, I don't know. That's a great question. I think just... I would kind of going back to what you had asked, you'd obviously done your homework and you'd asked and about my dad and the fact that, you know, trying to minister and help people along the way, I think would probably be the best thing. And that I know God's put me in an opportunity to be on the racetrack and then also be at the farm and try to impact, lives wherever I am.
What are some of the goals that would still be driving Elliot Walden and some of the things you still want to achieve?
Well, from a professional standpoint, obviously Windstar Farm is a farm that I think has an opportunity to be looked at 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now as a Calumet or a Claiborne type of farm that had a history of success on the racetrack, successes in the breeding. And so it's really an honor and a privilege to lead that charge and to you know, help and to, you know, just be with all the people there at Windstar that are so committed. So from that standpoint, it's extremely exciting to think about tomorrow. I know that with Super Saver, when he won the Kentucky Derby, that wasn't the end. That was just the beginning.
Yeah.
And so that's really gratifying.
You're wearing your Super Saver pullover now, and I did notice the colors are black and gold, by the way.
Yeah, I know you did because you're a Steeler fan.
You are not. You're a Cincinnati Bengal fan, diehard, right?
I am. Diehard Bengal fan. And so the Steelers are I pray for them.
Elliot Walden here on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. Just about 2 minutes left here, Elliot, but I always like to end by asking trainers to tell me something that most people out there might not know about them, whether it's different hobbies or different things you like to do away from horse racing. What would it be?
Well, you've covered it. I'm a pretty, straight kind of guy, and simple so sports are big. The competitiveness of horse racing, love being around the horses and then working and being with family are really the four things, and then tying in my faith with that. But really that the faith ties in with all four.
And you'll continue your work along with Pat Day with the racetrack chaplaincy as well. I know that's near and dear to your heart.
It is. The chaplaincy is a great mission and we also go to church here at Southern Acres and I'm an elder there, but I think wherever you are, whatever you're doing, you have an opportunity to impact the world for Christ, and that's my goal.
Well, it's been an absolute delight to hear your story and visit with you here tonight. Thank you for taking the time, and All the best moving forward. God bless.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike.
Elliot Walden here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Again, if you missed any portion of the show, you can go back to our website later on this evening, download it, listen to it whenever you'd like on podcast. You can do that on iTunes, on your phone, whatever it might be. Make sure you go back and check that out. Don't forget, we are your official home for the 140th Run for the Roses, your exclusive radio network for the Derby, for Churchill Downs, for the Kentucky Oaks, whatever it might be, is right here on HRRN. Follow us all the way through the Triple Crown and beyond. You can see a complete broadcast schedule on our website, horseracingradio.net. Great night here, Elliot Walden. Amazing stuff. Don't forget to listen to that podcast. For my producer, Lee Della Pina, and special guest, Elliot Walden, I'm Mike Pennell. We'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton.